Coming up on Life is a Festival.
The Dogara people will have a monthly grief ritual, and it's expected that everyone shows up to participate in that because there's a belief that untended grief will actually become harm in the form of violence or other social ills in the collective. And so it's actually taboo to miss that grief ritual. And I was really struck by that going through my own grief moment because I feel like it's very taboo in the West to grieve. And so this is kind of the opposite approach. Like, no, you need to show up and grieve. Otherwise, people are going to be asking you some questions. So those principles I really resonate with. And when I look at what's happening now in the world, it seems quite evident to me that there's a lot of ancestral dirty laundry, which is a term that Maladoma would use and talks about in his books. A lot of ancestral dirty laundry that needs to be addressed, that's piled up and is causing issues in the present.
Welcome back to Life is a Festival. I'm your host, Eamon Armstrong. And today on the show, we are welcoming back Camille Barton. Camille was on the show some time ago. I think it was episode 85. We've come a long way since then. And the occasion of their return to the program is the publication of their first book, which is called Tending Grief, Embodied Rituals for Holding Our Sorrow and Growing Cultures of Care in Community. Now, just in case you're curious about whether this all ties into festivals and raves and drugs and stuff, I promise it does. Camille is a former raver and they worked in drug policy. But in order to live a life like a festival, we must tend our grief. And as you'll understand in the conversation today, untended grief can lead to harmful consequences. We start our program with one of my favorite topics, which is healing culture and the difference between grief and the very, very popular concept of trauma that we all seem to talk about all the time, trauma. We discuss how Camille came to be writing this book from their experience in rave culture to recovering from an abortion. We discuss colonization, how hurt people, and how at some point we were all colonized. We discuss the limits of psychedelic medicine, another topic I'm very interested in, and then go deep into something called the void. Finally, we discuss how the Dogara people tend grief and Camille's various grief rituals that they include in the book, including how to make a grief altar. Camille Barton is a writer, an artist, and an embodied social justice facilitator. They are dedicated to creating networks of care and livable futures. As a facilitator, consultant, and curator, their work spans grief, pleasure, and drug policy. Camille is certified in the Resilience Toolkit and has developed themselves the GEN Grief Toolkit. Based in Amsterdam, they directed the Ecologies of Transformation Master's Program at the Sandberg Institute from 2021 to 2023. And Camille's recently released book, Tending Grief, explores collective grief and its impact on communities and is available now. And now, here's Camille. Camille, welcome back to Life is a Festival. You were on the show 3 years ago. And a lot has changed since then. That was during the pandemic time, and we were talking about grief rituals then, but you had not yet created this book you've just released. So some of these ideas were being embodied and explored at that time, and we discussed some of them on the previous podcast. So it's so exciting to have you back on the show to talk about this book you have just released. I am so happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be back with you.
I am curious about the idea of grief versus the idea of trauma. Trauma is everywhere. Trauma. We're all talking about my trauma, my healing journey. I don't think I hear anyone talk about grief at all. I don't feel like grief is coming up in this pervasive trauma conversation. So I think it's just a starting place to locate our listeners with your body of work. Can you explain what you mean by grief as opposed to trauma and where it sits in the modern wellness and healing conversation?
Great question.
With a simple question.
Yeah, nice and simple one. My sense is that grief relates to any of the emotions or sensations, mental loops that we experience after a loss, death, or something really core to who we are shifting in our lives. And I would say grief encompasses the journey it takes to really experience all of the ripple effects, the knock-on effects from that. And my hope would be that people can come to some kind of place where they feel a sense of ease or they've grown around that experience. But my sense of it is that because we live in such a grief and death phobic culture in most of the West, that many people aren't really stewarding or accompanying themselves in their grief process to grow around it. I think there's a lot of numbing and bypassing that we are often encouraged to do when we experience any kind of discomfort. And grief can bring up a lot of discomfort in the body and in the mind. In terms of its relationship to trauma, I do feel there's some entanglement there. And to be honest with you, I don't understand my own sense of it enough yet. But I do see in my own experience how intertwined they are to such an extent that people could say that grief and trauma are maybe the same elephant and just touching different parts of the same elephant. I think trauma in this moment is such a buzzword and is so associated with the medical model and the kind of Western therapeutic mental health system. That association rings really loud for me. Whereas grief doesn't have that medicalized association as much, for me at least. It doesn't mean that there aren't things like in the DSM-5 with this new disorder that's been created called prolonged grief disorder, which refers to grief that disrupts your work or day-to-day functioning for anything longer than 6 months to a year. And you can now be pathologized with prolonged grief disorder. So there are attempts to medicalize it, but given that there are so many different cultural approaches and embodied rituals to grief tending around the world, I don't think it's been captured as much as this term trauma, which seems to be more and more of a catch-all for kind of any negative experience that people have. And yeah, I wonder what it would bring for people to maybe identify with the term grief for some of these pieces and what that would change for folks if they actually held, okay, there is some grief here in my body. How do I want to approach that? How am I in relationship to that? I wonder what that would bring. The last thing I'll say for now is I do think that both grief and trauma in the Western context can be approached a bit like original sin. This kind of sense that we have this bad thing in us and we have to do everything we can to just get rid of it. We have to become pure and holy. And my approach is much more around not extracting it, but growing around it and with it and allowing it to be a teacher. And I see trauma in the same way. As much as I have engaged in processes to recover or repattern the impacts of that trauma. But I do think that both in the Western imagination, trauma and grief can be approached with this kind of need to get rid of as soon as possible kind of energy.
There's also this perpetual healing process. And I think that healing versus grieving is an interesting distinction in a capitalist context because wellness culture, healing is a doing thing and a consuming thing. And you do the retreat and you post on social media about your healing journey. And healing is this thing that you're doing and consuming and projecting and being an identity. Grieving is a much quieter thing. Grieving, you can't consume your way through grief. In fact, a lot of the best tools for grieving, and you've listed a lot of them in your book, a lot of these beautiful rituals, are not consumptive. They're not really something where you need to do like some sensational retreat or go sit with medicines in some faraway place. They are, even in the context of community, they are quieter, they're less sensational,
And not that grief is always quiet, I mean, but quieter in the sense of the sensationalizing narrative that we have in wellness culture. We're both fans of Adam's Healing from Healing work and poking fun at that, which, dear listener, if you have not followed the Healing from Healing Instagram, I think it's required reading at this stage. But one thing that came up in looking at your work is how different a culture of care and holding space for grief is from the modern culture of healing, which is more individualistic and really dovetails well with this sort of projection of self through social media. And I found that distinction to be really interesting and a transition from this never-ending healing to a kind of grieving that is allowing a natural process. I think there might be, it might be helpful for people to approach their healing from the perspective of grieving.
I love that you've outlined it that way. That's beautiful. And I agree with you. I think there is something to me when I take in wellness culture and some of the tropes that are so normalized and how people go about their own individualized healing path that still screams to me peak experience. This is a peak experience. I'm going on the ayahuasca journey to this bougie place and it's peak. There's a lot of output, like you're saying, whether it's financial, whether it's traveling around here and there. I think there is a kind of, yeah, energy of action. And what I notice for me, having been in a very kind of grieving body state, not having very much energy, needing a lot of internal cocoon time, is that there's a lot I associate with grief around softening and deepening and being more quiet, being more internal. And yeah, it's not really a peak experience thing in my experience of it. But I think that that chasing, that need for something that kind of is more akin to adrenaline or just bam, it's like a big sensational experience, can come from a lack of ability to sit with the quieter, softer internal places that might just be whispering, might sometimes be crying out, but require maybe a different pace and a different approach than the kind of go, go, go consumption approach, which does seem to be how a lot of people are operating. And I say that with a pinch of salt and without trying to come for people in a kind of attacking way, because I know a lot of people are just doing their best. But it does sit with me, this kind of the sense of like neoliberal pace, as opposed to a more kind of earth-based, nature-based pace of really composting, allowing things to break down slowly and witness that process of transition, as opposed to trying to fast track it in a week retreat. Yeah.
I love that your book is not simply a critique of certain things, although there's some element of critique in it, but actually tangible rituals that are effective for the processes that you're outlining as being more effective. So it's not simply, this is what's wrong with this particular way that we exist in the world, but here's an alternative. So we will definitely cover that in our conversation today. And I do want to come to this conversation about the void and about peak experience, because I am the audience of that section of the book. So we will, and this show is, you know, this show needs that section of the book. So we'll definitely get into that. But before we do, I want to come back to introducing the audience to you and to your work. And some of the audience may be familiar with your last appearance on the show. But I think the story of how this book came to be is another lens of understanding you. And I think that's going to give our audience a richer vantage point for them to integrate into their own experience where your wisdom comes from, because it's not just because you read all these cool books. There's a whole progression. And actually, your story and your story of embodiment mirrors a lot of the people who listen to the show because of how raves were one of the first places of healing for you. You were praying at the altar of the Unz, as many of us have so done, and there's a lot of commonality there. So I want to locate our audience in your journey of creating this piece of work. And I want to start with raves. Here's a quote from you. I obsessively devoured raves and nightlife every weekend to drink in enough pleasure to get through the following school week and distract myself from the grief lingering within me. Mental health challenges and heavy substance use were a part of my life at this time. Dance, altered states of consciousness, friendship, political somatics, and escaping my environment have kept me alive through the harder moments of my life. And so many people from so many backgrounds, particularly the type of people who listen to this show, can deeply resonate with rave culture, dance, altered states of consciousness as actually keeping us alive when it was hard to find joy elsewhere. So let's start there. When was the first moment that you were like, oh, wow, this is a kind of medicine for me? This isn't just hedonism. This isn't just partying. This is actually something that is nourishing me. This is something that my soul needs. Do you recall at a time thinking that, or is it more in retrospect that you look back at it that way?
There was definite awareness of it being healing. Yeah, being necessary. There wasn't another option for me, to be honest. It just felt, this is what I have to do. This is how I'm keeping going. And I would say that realization dropped as early as 14 or 15, I think. Growing up in North London, I know it's really different depending on where people grow up, but there were a lot of options, let's say, in North London to alter one's state of consciousness and to access various forms of warehouse parties, squat raves, a sprinkling of clubs. But there was enough kind of underground stuff happening that that's usually where I was, in a constellation of places. I think for many who grow up in families with recent histories of migration, there can be a lot of pressure academically to perform, to try and create the best hand, I suppose, that you might need to navigate these systems. I think it's quite common for many African heritage folks to be told, you know, you need to be twice as good to get anywhere in this world. So that was definitely a big part for me, of just feeling a lot of academic pressure and needing to maintain performance, but having a lot bubbling under the surface and just needing some kind of release, needing a space where I didn't have to be productive, where I didn't have to be smart or interesting or together. I could just be this amorphous moving blob of feeling and sensing. Yeah, it really kept me going, and it created the pathway that really led to more somatic practice and inquiry, because I would feel such a difference. Sometimes, you know, arriving to one of these spaces with so much heaviness, with racing thoughts, just feeling really scattered, and noticing after a few hours where certain things were located and moving in certain ways that would start to allow these pieces to be in conversation and to shift somewhat. I don't want to say it completely got rid of them, but there was enough shift and enough spaciousness to kind of get me through another week. So I'm very grateful for the self-medication and the access as well that I had to do that exploration relatively safely, because I know that's not the case for many people. It really is kind of a factor of context, where I grew up, which was in a predominantly white part of North London, where people had a lot of parents who'd gone to India and taken psychedelics. And so it was this slightly permissive space where the parents might not have known officially, but they probably did on some level know what we were doing when we were going out for benders for 2 days in a row and not coming home and then passing out all day on Sunday. So there probably was an inkling, but there was a lot of space and permission to explore relatively safely. And I know that's not the case for many people who grew up in more policed areas under the thumb of the war on drugs. But I managed to kind of maintain a relative amount of safety and explore and keep going, which I'm really grateful for.
I want to touch on another point in the journey of the birth of this book. I want to talk about this in part because I actually have a close friend who is just gone through this experience, which is after 2017, you went into a grief spiral after having an abortion. We're talking about grief as loss. And I think that it's really important. I think it's just really important to just talk about abortion a lot, and for men to talk about abortion a lot, and just talk about what that experience is and how much unexpected grief and pain can come that isn't really talked about, because there just isn't support around abortion. Mm. And as we're talking about this, I want to give a shout out to my mom, Sheila Armstrong, who worked as an intake administrator at an abortion clinic in New Mexico. I think it might have been Planned Parenthood. But her job was to be a mom at the abortion clinic and basically be the first point of contact. So shout out to Sheila. That was a really cool thing you did. And it definitely instilled in me a different relationship to abortion than I think many men have. And I think the fact that this was part of your process of understanding and building resilience around grief and building ways of being with grief, I think is quite important. And important for my friend who literally just had this exact experience where they had an abortion and just simply weren't expecting the level of grief. And they're doing much better now and supported by community. But I think this is a really important thing to name. And I think it's beautiful that you had this experience and then had a different kind of birth coming out of that, which was this book.
I guess this could be a good insight for people to some, to express that even if you mentally, rationally come to a decision about something like having an abortion, the body has its own timeline, its own way of doing things. And my body just went into a deep state of grief. What I didn't know until I had an abortion was that your body still thinks that it's pregnant for some time. So you have very high levels of hormones that are geared around being pregnant. Certain systems in the body are all directed in that capacity. And so when you have an abortion, there's this kind of drop off where the body is still thinking it's pregnant. And then those hormonal levels shifting and changing, but they're kind of being this, oh, where is this? Where is this being? What's happening? And so even if you've made the rational decision and you're really aligned with it, as I was, there is just this very physical component that means that your body is still having to adapt and adjust for at least a few weeks, if not longer, to that shift. And then the kind of physical and mental emotional components of that, I think, can be very strong. And no one gave me that information. There was no kind of harm reduction awareness around that. You have the Samaritan's phone number if you really need help in that way, but there's no information about what do you do with what comes out of you in that process. I did a whole burial process and ritual because I felt I need to do this, but there was no information about all the different physiological components of it, just as an experience. Yeah, aside from my body kind of readjusting to the different hormone levels and things, I just felt submerged, like really underwater. I felt like I was moving more slowly. I had way less energy. Colors seemed less bright. Just my whole way of perceiving reality was very, very different for a considerable amount of time. And yeah, there was a lot of anger arising because I didn't feel I had anywhere to go with this experience. I couldn't find spaces online or in person. I remember Googling abortion healing rituals and just found pro-life organizations. I just couldn't find anything. And I thought, this is so messed up. This is an experience that a huge amount of people have, just abortion alone. And I'm not saying everyone has a grief reaction to it, not at all. Some people don't, but I think many people do. And there is no space, or at least at that time, there was no space to really be in community with that. So I think it was the anger really and refusal to just be in a corner on my own with it that propelled me to try and steward myself and accompany myself through it as an intentional journey, because I didn't feel like I really had a choice about whether it was there or not. Everything had shifted and I felt like I needed to meet that somehow in a way that could be generative. And that's where the exploration came from. But in the midst of that experience, it did also give me insights. And this is reflected in one of the chapters where I talked to Zaki Brewster, who set up Doppo, which is an abortion companion service in London. And we just have a conversation that is rooted in a lot of the thoughts and processes that I was having in the months after, of just thinking, you know, when I would tell people I'm really grieving, I've just had an abortion, and they would say things like, oh, well, you made the right choice for you, so you should just feel okay about it. And there was no kind of understanding of the shades of gray, or the fact that you can feel like you've made the right choice and still have grief.
You can feel like you've made the right choice and still have grief. And that's true for so many different experiences. Grief is grief. It comes. It comes as it comes.
Yeah, and so this kind of rational bypassing thing of like, well, you made the decision, so just be okay with it. It just was another representation of the lack of space for nuance and complexity around emotions and being able to meet people where they are, which sometimes is in this messy contradiction of, yes, I made this choice and I stand by it. And also there are all these ripple effects and deaths of what it would have meant for me to parent. You know, will I parent again? Will capitalism ever enable me to feel resourced enough to do this? You know, all the questions that come and the sorrow that comes with that needed to find a space, and there was no public space for it. So I felt I needed to create that container for myself.
Curious, you have grief rituals in your book that are like specifically about abortion. And you were just talking about how you were looking for those resources and couldn't find them. Are you planning to have some of these rituals on your website and that are like searchable? Because I could imagine that someone will be typing into Google exactly what you were, and wouldn't it be lovely? Because you have specific rituals for this in the book. And yes, people should go out and buy the book, but I think it would be helpful to have that exact thing that you weren't able to reach, reachable in the way that you were trying to reach it.
Yeah, good point. I don't currently have any tags. Excuse my lack of SEO knowledge, but I don't think I have any keywords that would link people who are specifically looking for that. And that's a good shout for me to sit with that and think about what I could do to make that more accessible. I suppose what gave me pause is that I was looking for an abortion doula or an abortion companion that would kind of have an awareness of trans folks or non-binary folks having abortions, because that was also a part of it for me, of just lack of space for that. And so Doppo exists now. And so I know, okay, at least there's a place in England that people who have a similar experience to me could go and could get support. There's also Adia, who are a Muslim abortion companion. I don't know actually if they're abortion companion service, but they support Muslim folks who are having or have had historically an abortion. It feels like there are a few more coming up now that people can go to, but it would be good to think about that more and potentially to also run some spaces. So yeah, I'm going to sit with it. I'm just trying to go at a gentle pace and not take on too much. But I am doing rituals at the moment that are not specific to abortion, but either sharing circles or grief spaces, mixing with music and deep listening, or some that are dance-based. And those feel like good entry points initially, having experimented with some groups and found that the more kind of visceral, cathartic, embodied release rituals don't necessarily work for everyone who might not have done that kind of thing before. So I'm sort of exploring what good entry points feel like, and these seem like some of them for the moment. But yeah, I will make a note of what you said, because I think it makes sense.
You identify just a kind of general culture of looking away. That's very much been the case with challenging emotions in my family of origin and what's come through my ancestry. So we have this looking away challenge. And then on top of that, we have a very political tribalism. Much of your book is framed in the language of decolonization. And I think that for some, they may look at that and say, this is not for me because I feel like this isn't about me, or maybe this is a posture that's negative towards me and my identity, that I'm the bad guy here, so I don't want to read this. And as I was looking through this book and the way it unfolds and looking at the kind of the architecture and scaffolding of it, there's really important and valuable stuff for people of European ancestry. And in fact, you are partially of European ancestry as well. Yeah. We both have Celtic folks who, as you eloquently describe in the book, were also colonized and are also recovering from the horrors of Roman imperial colonization. So I want to just talk a little bit about the accessibility of this work. And for our listeners who might not identify with queer or BIPOC histories and the pain that's related to that, I want to encourage them to read this book as well. And I want to invite our listeners to step through what might feel like a barrier around this kind of siloed tribal framing that we have culturally at the moment.
I hear what you're saying, and I do agree that language is such a powerful thing and can become charged with so many associations that words can become barriers to certain people if they have certain experiences. So I want to acknowledge that. And there are also dynamics at play when it comes to marketing and speaking to the people who are the intended audience. And so, yeah, there are certain concerns I have around language that you've shared that I echo, because I think things are very charged right now. The main invitation from my side is for grief to really be seen as the universal denominator, the common denominator. We all, most of us anyway, will grieve or have already grieved. We're all going to die. We're all going to lose people that we love. And I think there is something beautiful about considering how we hold that process and how we can create spaces for each other, regardless of our backgrounds, to be in that process with more care and more intention, and to try and learn from what it can show us, what it can give us. And yes, being of partial European descent as well, I feel the grief and the disconnection that is very much a part of the histories of people who now identify as white or who are seen as white in the world day to day, whether they identify that way or not. There's a lot of dislocation and fragmentation. I have many friends, like the one I referenced at the beginning of the chapter, The Violence of the Void, who will openly express to me that they feel like they don't have any ancestral connection. They don't have any spiritual, intuitive stuff going on, that they feel fragmented from that. I feel sadness around that, because I think it's some kind of a wound that needs tending. But what I see happen in a lot of festival spaces, in the wellness and healing space, is sometimes a kind of bypassing of that wound and trying to fill it with different supposedly exotic or more spiritual traditions, rather than going back to that source of disconnect, which is oftentimes colonization, right? The different European traditions that exist, the different indigenous practices, land-based connections that people had in European lands before the encroachment of Rome, before being assimilated into other empires, whether it's also Irish and Scottish people who after Rome then got assimilated into what is now England or Great Britain. So there's been various forms of this happening. And there's a lot of wounding there. There is a lot of pain there. And I think it's important to make space for that and to be in conversation with that, rather than just trying to move on without really understanding what that has meant in terms of the lineages that we come from, and also how we show up in present time with other people and other beings, and how we want to hopefully become ancestors that leave a positive legacy and support the web of life in some way. I also think the witch burning times have had a huge impact on European peoples. It's not something we talk about a lot. I hope it becomes more spoken about, especially in this political moment when there is so many attempts on the right to take away the autonomy of female assigned people, women and female assigned people, to be able to have abortions or choose how we reproduce, which was also a huge component of the witch burning times, was taking away that autonomy from women, taking away herbal and plant medicine knowledge systems, and really making way for the development of the kind of institutionalized medical model that we have now in the West. These are deep histories that are very entangled with how we live today. And yet many people don't really have a sense of these things and how they've impacted us. So I do think there's a lot in there for European descendant folks, and an invitation to do this work, not out of sense of duty, or not to be someone that's seen as good or doing the right thing, but out of a sense of doing it for your own lineage, for being in reconnection with that, and actually feeling some kind of shared stake in what's happening in the world now, not looking at the situation unfolding in Palestine or in Congo or Sudan as like the other over there that's in this disconnected state, but really to see these processes of colonization that are taking place on these lands to these peoples as something that has also happened to you and to your people, just much further ago in time than this moment. So I think there is a space for commonality and coalition when we lean into our histories and we actually reckon with what has also happened to us. And so then I think it takes away this dynamic of saviorism that can come through or feeling like we need to help people and show them the way. I think there can be a beautiful moving together somewhere else if we really reckon with the ways that colonization has impacted many of our lineages and have created wounds that I think we still need to address generationally.
This is a subject matter that is very near and dear to my heart and something that I think a lot about. So your book was really helpful in the context of my own inquiry. I think for one thing, we have to understand that people are at different developmental stages in relation to their identity and the world. And so, you know, when I was in college and I was studying whiteness at Occidental College, it was very binary for me. Whiteness is bad, and I need to be a good white person by doing everything I can to dismantle whiteness. I don't have that same perspective now, and I find that sort of reductive and lacking nuance. One of the first steps is to just expand the ability to see people in their individual journeys. I think that's really helpful versus getting into these harsh binaries. At the same time, forgiving people for their harsh binaries because everybody's at their stage of understanding. And the more work you've done, the more you've read, the more you've seen the world, the more expansive your understanding of how people can be and their histories and how there's so many not bad people. And there's so much that's not about bad people. And what comes to me is this idea of hurt people hurt people. My lineage on my father's side, Irish convicts sent to Australia. So colonized by the British, traumatized by the British, sent to Australia, where they colonized and traumatized Aboriginal people there, the native people of Australia. And that actually exists in my lineage in the present tense. It doesn't exist in my lineage in the past. It exists in my lineage now as I do my healing around my childhood and my relationship to my father, who is the product of that culture. Mm-hmm. So for me, there is a relationship to colonization that is day-to-day present in my experience. And I've had to unearth it. And interestingly, where I got the biggest gift in that was African indigenous medicine, was Iboga with the Bwiti people. That was like the deepest ancestral healing I got was from they call it the Tibet of Africa, these extremely spiritually profound Bwiti people in Gabon, which also does tap into, everything is so complex. It taps into this issue of exotic travel for peak experiences. So there's some of that too. And I think the more we have capacity for nuance and we can hold others' experience, the more healing and generous we are able to be to ourselves and others. And I think you've just hit the nail on the head, both in this conversation and in your book, that grief is actually an equalizer in that and an access point in it, because the fact of the grief in my lineage does not negate the grief in your lineage. And actually there is grief in my lineage because of the way that it has hurt other people too. There's not like a hierarchy of pain and suffering. I think we need to be realistic about who's having a more challenging time with modernity and who's not, and that identity plays a role in that, but that we are all suffering in this unfolding of choices that none of us made that place us in these kind of identity positions in the world. And the more generous and kind we can be to everyone, including ourselves, that to me is what creates broader healing. And I think this access point of grief work, I think that's really key, because when I look at my parents, mother's side Scottish industrialist, father's side Irish convicts, neither of my parents know how to grieve, like at all. They just don't know how. They don't have any grief rituals. They do not make altars. All the things that you've listed in your book are completely foreign to my family. My mom takes naps and my dad drank alcohol. He no longer does, but my mother took naps, my dad drank alcohol. Which is just avoiding grief, and then that grief metastasizes into a way of being in the world that causes harm to others.
Yeah.
And I think when we honor that, it brings us into a space of more commonality.
Yeah. It feels like generally our elders just had to kind of get through and do the best they could do at the time. And I know that my elders also don't have a kind of approach to grieving. And I have a lot of compassion. I haven't always felt compassion about it, but I currently feel more and more compassion because they just didn't, that space wasn't given to them. And if I think about colonization in my lineage, the most recent examples, my grandma, you know, grew up under British colonial rule in Guyana, going to a Catholic school. It's not something that's that distant. And so I'm trying to have a lot more compassion for the ways that's then shaped my mom. And then the ways that's, you know, just the ripple effect, I think, can show a lot of the impacts of these things. But what's beautiful is we do have a lot more tools and techniques and possibilities to experiment, to actually develop different practices and hopefully not create the same kind of conditions for the generations to come, whether they biologically come from us or not. And I also, bringing back to this point around your incredible healing with the Bwiti people, I know that I'm a little bit shady in the chapter of talking about this wellness culture moment, but I do understand and have compassion that, you know, people may not know how to access spaces like this in the lands they live on, because many of our medicine traditions and lineages have also been interrupted because of colonization. So I think there is a need to kind of redevelop and reclaim ways to hold space with integrity and develop embodied ethics around that, so people don't feel they have to travel far and go into other cultural contexts, but that we can reclaim the space and capacity to actually support our community move through times of challenge and transition, and to be and move through grief. But because we've lost a lot of that skill, I think there's this externalizing that's happening, whether it's with medicine traditions and communities outside of the West, or even the idea that we need to go to therapists to process all of our stuff. I love my therapist, don't get me wrong. They've been a profound support in my life. Doing somatic therapy for the last 3 years with them has been really, really, really helpful. And also, I don't vision a future where everyone is just having one-to-one therapy. I don't think it's sustainable for the therapists themselves. And I don't think it actually supports us collectively to be where we need to, because it is necessary to have some skill to hold discomfort and to hold change and transition. And what I see now is this very individualized model where if something comes up, we just say like, oh, you should take that to a therapist. Don't bring that to me. Take that over here. And not everyone can access therapy financially or find someone who works for them with their specific lived experience. And I find that also because of this lack of skill and investing in having the support to care for people, it then tends to be the same people in community who are expected to be the receptacle for all of this. And that can take a toll. I know that's been me in many contexts within my life, where people just expect me to kind of hold all of it. And I'm looking around and thinking, well, who else can hold some of this too? But it seems to be very asymmetric and kind of not dispersed and held enough in the collective. And so that's one of my big hopes for the book, really, is that it can inspire us to have more skill and practice and experiment with ways where we can hold things more on a community level and not need to outsource our grief or our trauma to other people, to other cultures, to paid professionals, but actually can kind of build infrastructures of care so that it's more of a choice. There are more possibilities and we don't have to feel that need to kind of outsource and bring it somewhere else. And I know that will take time, but I think it is really necessary in these times because they're asking a lot of us.
And I think that this is especially true in the burgeoning space of psychedelic assisted medicine. And you have a section in your book that relates to this, which of course you do because you've done important work in this field. In fact, that's how we know each other, is through your work in the psychedelic community. And I think it's really important that when we look at grief work and healing, that this kind of expensive one-size-fits-all version of psychedelic medicine that's culturally rooted in the 60s and in a sort of like westernized version of Buddhism. It's basically like anything Aldous Huxley had to say seeded psychedelic medicine today. So we have this kind of cultural legacy that is very much of the times that these books were written, like The Doors of Perception, et cetera. And then we also have it squarely in a capitalist context where the MAPS protocol for MDMA-assisted therapy is exorbitantly expensive. And the answer is so obviously that it needs to be held in a communal space as well. It's fascinating that that BIPOC historical approaches to psychedelics or to entheogens or plant medicines are actually better than the Western model. And the Western model, I'd say better, but I think better for everyone. I think I can fairly say better for everyone. And the Western model specifically excludes BIPOC folks because of their traumatic history with the war on drugs. Isn't that kind of like a mm-hmm. fucked up way for this to have unfolded? That actually the indigenous wisdom keepers had the model and we could do that model, but instead we're shoehorning it into a Western medical model, which specifically excludes the very people who had developed these medicine traditions. What can we do about that? let's solve that on this podcast.
Yeah, let's solve it. Stat. Yeah, the big takeaway for me is I hope that we can break down the separation between the broader drug policy reform movement, harm reduction movement, and the psychedelic assisted therapy space and movement, because to me, they're not separate. But there's so much psychedelic exceptionalism. I'm sure many listening will know what that means. But for those who don't, this kind of idea that psychedelics are somehow good drugs that are special and better than other substances. And so they should be protected and engaged with, whilst other drugs should still be illegal and people who use them should still be criminalized. There's still a lot of psychedelic exceptionalism in this moment, I think partially to do with the kinds of media and the mainstreaming of psychedelic therapy that's happening. Often doesn't include a lot of information about the war on drugs or about legality or risk, which I think is very confusing for a lot of people who seem to believe that because they've seen something on Netflix, now they can just, you know, go and ask for mushrooms anywhere and they're going to be okay. So I'm really concerned for people actually a lot because there's just a lot of confusing information. But what I would advocate for anyone who's really committed to these medicines, these plant teachers, entheogens, sacred earth medicines, whatever you call them, if you're really committed to this being accessible, then please join the movements for decriminalization and legalization and contribute to that, because I don't think the medical model is going to be sufficient to actually undo the harms that are present time. Even if we just look at the cannabis reform movement in the US, you know, that can give us somewhat of a map of what this could look like, where you still have many people, predominantly men of color, in prison for personal possession of cannabis, sometimes in the same states where there are booming cannabis industries now, mostly led by white folks who've had the money to invest in licenses. And so we see this kind of disparity, and ultimately this isn't making the medicine more accessible to everyone. It's still excluding people from accessing it. So if there's a real belief in these medicines and the healing potential, then I think we need to be moving in the direction of decriminalization and legalization and really getting into the policy around, are we going to have the right to cultivate at home? Are we going to have the right to hold our own spaces? And becoming much more nuanced about what these proposals are, because depending on how it's put together, it will have drastically different impacts on our ability to commune with and work with these entities. So yeah, I think we do need to be a little bit more joining forces, building coalitions with the drug policy movement and not kind of hiding out in the psychedelic exceptionalism bubble, because it ultimately isn't actually going to make this more available for the majority of people.
I'm going to take this moment to let the listeners know that the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is returning, and all of the psychedelic content that I am doing will be in that space. And this is one of the key aspects that I'm really interested in. It's always been something mm-hmm. I've really been interested in, but I think in this moment in what has been dubbed the Psychedelic Renaissance, have we rebranded that yet? Do we have a different name for it?
We should try and get another name.
Yeah, let's get another name. Well, the movement formerly known as the Psychedelic Renaissance needs to move into some new phases. And so that's one of my commitments with the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, which is returning. And you and I haven't spoken on that show yet. So we'll have to do that if you'd like to. And we can get deeper into this material. And just to flag that for listeners who are really interested in psychedelic healing, that's the space where I will be hosting more of those conversations. There's also just so much I still want to talk to you about. So we're going to veer away from psychedelics in this moment. I want to talk about the void. I want to talk about the Dogara people. And I want to talk about grief rituals. So we've got a couple of big things as we come to the final third of this show. So let's start with the void. The void is such a potent concept and helpful to me because I feel it. Helpful to this conversation about people of European heritage and a kind of grief that exists largely with people of European heritage, and a kind of grief that propels this kind of healing tourism that I have absolutely taken part in and is something that I am more and more aware of and deconstructing in my own experience. And so this is the opening of your chapter on the void, and I'm going to read it and then we'll take a little moment to discuss the void. This is what you write, opening the chapter on the void. Grief has become an emergent topic of conversation in many of my friendships. While I was walking with a friend who identifies as white, they spoke of their desire to do ancestor healing work and the challenges of this, since they had little connection with their living ancestors, let alone the ones who came before. My friend expressed some envy about my ability to connect with my Yoruba, Guyanese, and Celtic ancestors, to know my lineage and to be in relationship with it. This sparked a rich conversation between us about grief, colonization, loss, and the violence of the void. The sense of internal emptiness that many white people feel, a sense that they have no culture, no richness, no ancestral wisdom to connect with or lean upon. It is this sense of emptiness that I believe is the driving force for cultural appropriation and other intersecting harms rooted in extraction and domination. Here's another way of putting it. So many Westerners are ready and willing to throw their mongrel history over the side of the spiritual smooth sailing they imagine comes with imbibing an intact culture. And we're going to go even deeper for this audience, and I'll do one more paragraph. But this is for me, and for many of our listeners, this is for you. There is a violence in the void. The emptiness is a hungry, cannibal-like eraser that has consumed many indigenous and traditional cultures over the last 500 years. Do not mistake the void for nothingness. Lying beneath are the tendrils of pain, the stories of empire and conquerors whose ancestors at one point were the conquered. Other manifestations of the void can be seen in behaviors of domination, whether this is anthropocentrism, ableism, racism, sexism, transphobia, or homophobia. A feature of this space can be the ongoing sensation of being incomplete, of needing exotic rituals or cultural practices to take away the gnawing feeling of not being spiritual, kind, or open-hearted enough. People experiencing the void often have an urge to consume excessively, hoping that the next peak experience will result in a lasting sense of satisfaction. You choose an endless circuit of tantric retreats. Oh God, this is so on point. You choose an endless circuit of tantric retreats, festivals, and plant medicine experiences in the jungle, all dressed in the notion of doing the work. You pay lip service to oneness, but rarely move beyond the dominance of the individual. You take what you need, believing everything to be yours anyway, to temporarily bypass the feeling of emptiness, the void churning underneath. Untouched and unprocessed, strengthened by the need to extract and consume. You get a quick fix, potentially in another dose of peak experience, ignoring the shadow that cries out for integration. Fuck. of your whole book, this is the part that I read and I was just like, damn. This is very, very, very true to my experience in my life. Having the resources as I do to do a healing journey, to go to these places, to be able to tell people, I did this thing, this peak experience, and to continue to have a persistent sense of emptiness. Now, I think for me, I've been able to touch the void in a way that I've actually found some deeper connections, somewhat. I'm still a baby in many ways on this subject. And I think that for people of my heritage, this is the moment in your book, this concept of the void, that is just so potent. And so since I've set the table with how you've opened the chapter, I'd love for you to describe a little bit about what shall we do, those of us who experience the void in our being and are seeking other cultures, spiritual or ancestral lineages, as if we can somehow make ourselves whole.
Thank you for this question. I sense that looking into your own histories, own ancestral lineages is a really great place to start. Kind of what you were speaking to in your own journey, starting to map out, even a few generations back, what some of the harms were that your ancestors experienced and whether those then connected to harms they consciously or unconsciously enacted onto others and what those conditions were. And if it's possible to go further back to see what land-based traditions, what spiritual traditions may have been intact before assimilation, that could also be really powerful. I know that many people who live in the United States who've come from, say, Polish or Irish, Italian backgrounds, may only a few generations ago have had more intact practices that were then suppressed or assimilated as a means to integrate into United States culture and into whiteness more broadly. So I think there may be some places to gain insights and understand where these moments of fracturing occurred. And if there are remnants or traces or ways of engaging with one's ancestry that feel generative to bring into present time and to bring into practice, and just seeing as an experiment what that brings. If there's a way to just notice what that brings on a kind of body, mind, spirit level. I kind of advocate this because ultimately, if we go back far enough, we will come towards people who did have traditions that would be more akin to what we'd call like indigenous traditions, cosmologies, ways of viewing existence and participating in life that were more collective, that were land-based, that were rooted in the seasons, and that created a sense of wholeness, of being rooted in place. And even if we don't necessarily feel that in ourselves in present time, just knowing that we're connected to that might give some breadcrumbs as to how we could create rhythms and ways of engaging that would reconnect to the lands we live on, to being in right relationship in the context we find ourselves in. So I don't have a kind of straight trajectory, but I think a big part of it begins with looking into our lineages and understanding where that fragmentation took place and where these kind of intersecting moments of cycles of harm and violence relate to our own family histories and contexts. And this in and of itself might feel uncomfortable at first, because I know that in many families, there is a culture of silence. So we don't look back, we don't talk about it, or pretending that we don't know. And so this piece may be more complex for different people. There may be a need to go into some public records or do some digging if you can't get information from your elders, if they are still here. But I do think this is really worthwhile. And I'll be honest, it's been easier for me in recent years to connect with my African heritage ancestors and relatives. But I'm feeling this need, for the same reason, to get clearer on my dad's side of the family, on their histories, particularly since they were colonized, because I could go back to this kind of glorious, intact Celtic indigeneity. And as a teenager, I really flirted with that. I was very into kind of circle-based processes and things, I guess, that would be called more akin to Wicca, looking at Druid practices and things like this. And I just bypassed, skipped over all the hundreds of years when they started harming other people after that. But now I'm really wanting to look at that and understand, okay, how did you make it through? How did you make sense of this dislocation? What did that mean for you and how you showed up and what you participated in? And just getting clearer about those stories. Does it mean I need to claim all of those ancestors? Not necessarily, but I'm in relationship to them, whether I want to be or not. And I think the more I can integrate that, the more of a sense of wholeness there is for me. And I can get clearer about what it means to live in alignment given those stories and those histories, and potentially repair things that might need repair, that might feel good to repair on their behalf as well as my own, for the life that I want to live in relation to different peoples, different beings. So that's what I would suggest as a start point.
I have a couple of shout outs here. Nick Mulvey, the musician, has recently worked with Northern European Indigeneity. He's been on a journey in connecting with his own ancestry, and we did a podcast directly about that some time ago, maybe 2 years ago. I was recently with Dara Stewart, who is in the psychedelic community. He's a PhD biologist and a sort of amateur Celtic shaman, I would call him. I recently was with him in Ireland, visiting sacred sites and learning from him, and him talking about how ancient Ireland was quite similar to the Amazon in that it was a network of rivers through these impenetrable forests that had been seeded into food forests with, instead of ayahuasca, they were using these liberty cap mushrooms. So we did a podcast about that I want to give a shout out to Dara Stewart's work. And then for me, what's been most nourishing has been my exploration of myth. Myth has just become so potent in my life. The different mythic traditions that are deep in my ancestry. And I want to give a shout out to the Emerald podcast. I don't know if you've listened to Josh's work on the Emerald, but when I think about people who just seem to know how to discuss these things in ways that are so inclusive, Josh's work with mythology and Sophie Strand's work with mythology, a lot of the people who are doing cool shit with mythology, they seem to really offer a lot of nourishing. It's not adversarial or antagonistic. It's not shame-based around identity. And so the work of Sophie Strand, the Emerald, I mean, there's really good shit out there. So I'll put some of those resources in the show notes as well. So
nice.
Let's now talk about the Dagara people. Now, how do I pronounce it? Is it Dagara?
Yeah, Dagara.
Okay. So can you tell me, who are the Dagara people? And why has their approach to grief been such an important model for you?
Yes. So my understanding of the Dagara people is really through the lens of two of their elders, Maladoma Solme and Sobhonfu Solme, who are no longer alive, but I did get the pleasure of attending one of Sobhonfu's grief rituals when she was alive in California around 2014 or 15. And both Maladoma and Sobhonfu spent a lot of their lives living in the West and spreading Dagara grief rituals throughout the Western world. And they have various interviews you can find on YouTube, and they've both written really wonderful books. I was introduced to their work, I think, through my mum, actually. She gave me one of Maladoma's books, Of Water and the Spirit, when I was quite young. I think I was in my teens when I read it for the first time. And so it's been a book I've continued to return to, and it was probably the first access point I had to understanding a kind of magical, or for lack of a better term, shamanistic tradition on the continent. So it was quite important for me. But when I went to California and went to this grief ritual, Sobhonfu, that was the first time I'd ever really participated in a grief ritual, in a formal grief ritual. And I felt so at home, so grateful to just be in a space where people didn't have to pretend to be okay and could really hold each other in this beautiful container that was quite durational. I think it was about 5 hours long. And it was a really powerful space that planted a seed in me that I think is still growing. And it's very much a cornerstone for the book, both of their work. So in the Dagara context, there are some very particular ways of seeing grief and its importance in the world. So one of the ideas that really stuck with me earlier on is this sense that grief is a generative force, that it supports the well-being of a community at large, for people to be in relationship and regular practice with tending their grief. And so an example of this is that in the traditional Dagara context, I should say Maladoma and Sobhonfu's Dagara village was in Burkina Faso, but that's not where all the Dagara people are. Colonial borders have divided them, but they grew up in Burkina Faso. The Dagara people will have a monthly grief ritual, and it's expected that everyone shows up to participate in that, because there's a belief that untended grief will actually become harm in the form of violence or other social ills in the collective. And so it's actually taboo to miss that grief ritual. And I was really struck by that going through my own grief moment, because I feel like it's very taboo in the West to grieve. And so this is kind of the opposite approach. Like, no, you need to show up and grieve. Otherwise, people are going to be asking you some questions. And yeah, so those principles I really resonate with. And when I look at what's happening now in the world, it seems quite evident to me that there's a lot of ancestral dirty laundry, which is a term that Maladoma would use and talks about in his books, a lot of ancestral dirty laundry that needs to be addressed, that's piled up and is causing issues in the present. And so for the Dogara people, there is a sense that tending to grief also enables us to access ancestral wisdom and to get clear on what our gifts are and how we can actually support the collective, what our role is, what we can contribute to support the web of life. And so they also see it as something that's very spiritual. It's not a waste of time or this inconvenient set of emotions that we need to just rush through as quickly as possible. It's really seen as the site of kind of spiritual, sacred connection, where we're offering what is too heavy to hold. And in return, the earth can hold that, can take that from us, and we're able to receive clarity, to receive wisdom around what is most aligned for us, how we can show up in service of the collective. So although I'm not within the Dogara cosmology, that's not my kind of background or how I'm in practice spiritually, I'm deeply influenced by these principles and these ways of seeing grief, and I very much resonate with them and have tried to incorporate these ideas into the framework around grief tending that I'm experimenting with, which also is not a Dogara grief ritual. I want to be clear about that. The rituals I outline are quite accessible and really geared around helping people to move out of numbing, which is a state I think many of us are in a lot of the time in the West, and to kind of over time build the capacity to be with grief and bigger sensations. And so Dogara style grief rituals will often be durational, often include drumming, different altars, and quite cathartic embodied release. And I think they are beautiful and massively encourage people to seek out practitioners who've been trained by Sobhonfu and Maladoma. There are quite a few who are alive and active. But my sense is that because so many people don't know how to be with big sensation and it can be overwhelming and too much, it's also important to have other access points to explore grief that can be more supportive for the nervous system over time to build up that bandwidth so that we don't have to go into overwhelm or dissociation or bypassing. It's just a different approach, but very much rooted in the same kind of ideas.
So we're going to close our conversation today by specifically talking about a grief ritual. And I'm going to call back in my mother, Sheila Armstrong, because I'm buying my mother your book. My mother lost her mother, Elspeth Bobbs, her best friend, and her sister the following year. Both women died on my mother's birthday, 1 year apart.
Oh my goodness,
so,
wow.
Strong experience for my mother. My mother had no kind of grief practice. Her grief practice was to take a nap. And she had unprocessed grief from another sister dying when she was 19. So the amount of dysregulation for my about to be 75-year-old mom, this was a few years ago, was enormous. She had absolutely no tools. And it's very common for people to have absolutely no tools. And so I want to call her in this moment and just offer this part of the conversation as much as it is mine to offer this part of the conversation. I want to offer to Sheila, my mom. The two that I was looking at in the book that were most resonant to me were dance, which I know has been a really big part of your experience, and the grief altar. And the grief altar is a really cool idea. And actually, Ram Dass has a bit about the grief altar. Have you ever come across Ram Dass's grief altar bit?
No, I know of Ram Dass, but if I'm honest, I haven't dived deeply into his work. So that's news to me, but that's cool and makes a lot of sense.
I'll send you something because I basically he says that we have to train ourselves to grieve because loss is something that builds over your life. The older you get, the more you lose. And so if you don't train grief rituals, it's very aligned with some of what you share here. If you don't train these grief rituals, then as you lose things, you lose friends, you lose loved ones, you lose health, you simply won't have ways of processing. And he recommends creating an altar for your grief and designating time to sit with that altar, which is quite similar to what you were sharing. So maybe let's go with the grief altar if you feel good about that one.
Yes.
And then just to flag for the listener, there are a number of grief practices in your beautiful book, but the altar is so cool. It's like the Dia de Muertos ofrenda. Like there's a lot about altars and ancestors. So maybe as a way of closing the conversation, perhaps you can share with the listeners and my mom, how do you make a grief altar?
I would love to share this. So the way I like to create an altar is to first find a space that I'm going to see daily, that's somewhere that feels present, that's in the center of my home or somewhere that I can spend time with regularly. And to begin by finding some kind of cloth, this might be a white cloth or something more colorful that will create a sense of it being special or a bit sacred. I then select photos of ancestors who I feel have my back or feel in alignment with me. They don't have to be biological ancestors, but just people who've really shaped our lives that we feel in lineage with, that we might want to be in conversation with in some way. I then like to place flowers, or I have a living plant currently on my altar. And I also like to include a couple of small either jars or kind of small vessels, one that I fill with water regularly and one that I like to fill with the alcohol of choice that my ancestors enjoyed. So many of the ancestors on my altar enjoyed gin, and I usually make sure there's some gin in that vessel as well. So some kind of living plant, photos of ancestors you want to be in conversation with, and water and some alcohol of choice are just some of the things that are on my altar. But there might be other things that people feel called to. It's just whatever is going to create somewhat of a sacred space that when you come to this place, you feel a sense of permission and encouragement to talk about your problems or share what's going on in your life or engage with some other form of grief practice. But as a baseline, I think it's almost like a spiritual resting place that you can have in your home space to build up some kind of ancestor practice and create a beautiful zone for ritual. So that would be my suggestion.
And once you have created this grief altar, I presume you have one of these in your home at present. Is that the case?
Yes.
And how do you relate to it in an ongoing way?
It depends on the day, but my daily practice is going into my little kind of ancestor room, my ritual room, and usually lighting some incense, either meditating in front of the ancestor altar or just sending some kind of prayers or intention for things I'd like to see in the world or in my own life. So that's kind of on a daily basis, often checking in, sharing things that are coming up for me, trying to share things that maybe I want some wisdom or support with. But when it comes to ritual, I tend to do my grief rituals in front of my ancestor altar as well. So the most regular one for me is an adapted version of the grief jar practice, which comes from Trisha Hersey, who created the Knapp Ministry. And this practice involves having a jar that I keep on my altar, and I usually have some small pieces of paper cut up next to it. And when a moment of grief moves through me, or there's some loss or something which I might not have time to engage with in the moment, I generally write it on the piece of paper and put it in the jar. And then when the full moon comes around, it's just personally when I like to do a grief ritual, then I spend some time first beginning by kind of lighting a candle on my ancestor altar. I forgot to say that. Always having a candle on there, and usually lighting the candle every evening is part of the daily practice. But I usually light the candle then and do an embodiment practice to ground and sense how I'm feeling. And then take the time to go through each piece of paper with these pieces of grief from the month. And just to notice what the body sensations are for me, to notice if there are tears that need to come, if there are words that need to come or songs that want to be sung. Sometimes songs come out. If there are tremors or shakes or other movements that want to release. And just spending time, it might be 20 minutes, sometimes it's more like an hour and a half, depending on what I have capacity for. But just spending some time to be with these pieces of grief and to really feel them on an embodied level. And then when I'm ready to kind of allow them to shift or let go in some way, I'll usually allow them to dissolve in a basin of water. Depending on your situation, if you had access to a fire, you could also burn them in a fire. But that's my baseline monthly practice. And I like to do that kind of by my ancestor altar. So there's some kind of connection and witnessing as well taking place.
And like many practices, the daily relationship, the building of the practice means that it's there for you when the winds of fortune change and when you're really going through something. If you don't yet have these practices, start them. And when the time comes, whether you are in grief in this moment or whatever comes in our lives, that they're there for you. And I think many of the ways that we relate to being a human is through these kind of these practices that gently shift things in our being.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many of these practices in your beautiful book, Tending Grief. And we have not in any way gone deep in all the different facets of it. We didn't have time today to discuss Aisha Mirza's Sober Club Misery, which I thought that was a really great section of the book. So that's something for the listener to check into as well, this kind of sober partying healing space. There's a lot of great stuff in this book. And I'm so honored that you wanted to be on my show to talk about it. It's nice to see you again. And it was really lovely to talk about this stuff and also to talk about some stuff that's alive for me just outside of this conversation. Some of the stuff around identity is always interesting to me. So it's really nice to talk to someone who knows a lot about what we're trying to discuss and can approach it with such grace and inclusivity. It's very meaningful to me. So thank you.
Thank you for having me on. It's been a really lovely conversation.
So the book is Tending Grief.
That's the main title. And then there's a subtitle, which is Embodied Rituals for Holding Our Sorrow and Growing Cultures of Care and Community.
Growing Cultures of Care and Community, as we all need. Well, the book is available now. There'll be a link to it in the show notes. I highly recommend it, and I will be buying a copy for my mother. Thanks for coming on the show. Thanks for teaching us, and thanks for taking your place in the pantheon of many of the writers who you've quoted in the book who are friends and heroes of yours. You have made a worthy contribution to the body of work in this subject of healing and growth and connection with each other. So I salute you and thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for Life is a Festival. If you like the show, you can support it by sharing it with your friends, following it on Spotify, or reviewing it on iTunes. If you'd like to get more involved, you can join our Facebook group, Life is a Festival, where we talk about the show and you can suggest new guests. If you really liked the show and maybe want a little bit more, visit my digital tip jar at patreon.com/lifeisafestival.com. Whatever you do, I hope today's podcast helped you make your life just a little bit more like a festival, and I'll see you on the dance floor.